Joining me for the next 15 minutes or so, I am delighted to say that we have managed to track down someone who's very busy at the moment with her own job and also in relation to collaborating to help government understand COVID-19 and what it may yet do to our population, the Director of Modeling and Simulation Hub Africa at the University of Cape Town is joining me now, Dr. Sheetal Salal. Let's see whether I've got a nice clear line here, and technology hopefully won't fail me. Dr. Salal, good morning to you, and thank you so much at short notice as well for agreeing to come on my show. I'm absolutely delighted.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Can I start by asking some absolutely basic questions? As I said to you, this is going to be a sort of 101 on modeling so that we understand the news last night that have made many South Africans nervous about projections of infections for COVID-19 and possible deaths by November. Let's do it very, very slowly. When you and your colleagues build a maths model to try and understand how something like a virus will behave in a population, how do you go about doing that kind of thing?
Sure, thank you. I think this is really one of the key questions that needs to be answered right now. So a mathematical model is basically a description of the world, or any model is trying to be a description of the world. And in mathematical modeling of disease, what we're seeking to do is to describe how the disease behaves and transmits through a population. And given that each population is different around the world and even within countries, we try to capture these differences in our models. So mathematical modeling, as much as it's called mathematical modeling, it's really a multidisciplinary process. We take into account the data that has been collected by the governments and other academic parties. We take into account the biologists, those in the public health system, the doctors, the clinicians, the intensivists who are all treating patients. We take into account the economics and the resources involved in providing this treatment. And what we do is we research through scientific literature and published literature around the world as to what is best understood about the disease. And then as modelers, our job is to really synthesize all of this information into a framework that we can use to simulate or to represent how the disease is behaving in a particular population. Mm. So it's very much a collaborative process, very much multidisciplinary. Yeah?
That is fascinating. My apologies for interrupting there. Can we next talk about where one goes to in order to build the main mathematical equations into which you will put the input data? And what I mean by that, which may be slightly imprecise technical language, but just stay with me on the question, is do we, for example, assume that epidemiologically the way the virus may behave in the South African population will be similar to how it had behaved in China, in Italy, in the USA? How do we build a model that has got built into it, into the algorithms, as best an understanding of the unique South African facts that you cannot borrow from the behavior of the virus in population groups around the world?
Sure. So this is where the research into what the risk factors are for the disease comes into play. And as we mentioned yesterday, the models are quite iterative. As new research emerges in the world as to risk factors and ways to combat the disease, we then will include these and update our models as time goes along. So if you think about COVID-19, one of the major risk factors that has emerged in the world and been documented several times is that of age, in terms of severity of infection affecting those in the older populations to a worse degree, to a larger degree than other age groups in the population. So in doing so, we would be looking, for example, at age-specific rates of disease severity and age-specific rates of mortality, and then apply those to the age distribution in South Africa. So in no way are we saying we will expect the disease to behave in exactly the same way as it does, for example, in Italy, which has an older population compared to South Africa, but rather we'd look at the severity rates per age class and then adjust them to our population. So in this way, we make these adjustments to the South African population.
One of the concepts that many of us wish we had paid better attention to at high school is, of course, the idea of exponential spread. And one of the reasons I suspect, and I'm guessing here, why a lot of people would have either not slept if they read the news last night on News 24, or this morning would have had consternation waking up to a headline that says, grim COVID-19 projections for South Africa, 40,000 deaths, 1 million infections, as well as a dire shortage of ICU beds. Let's take each of those in turn, Dr. Silal, and explain to the public how one arrives at projections, both conservative and optimistic ones. We may as well go for the most horrible, which is deaths in our population, which is the last thing that we want. When we say by November, 40,000 deaths could be a reality in South Africa, but right now the numbers are still relatively low in absolute terms, how do we get to that projection?
So the model is driven by the parameters, the assumptions, and the data that are used to train it or to build it, right? And one of the things we have to understand is that while we have incorporated the scientific research as best we know it as a modeling consortium in the country into developing these models and providing these predictions, this estimate of 40,000 deaths in November may very well not come to pass if we introduce new interventions in the future, if the population responds or adapts behavior to accommodate the severity of the disease and so forth. So these, I think it's very important to realize and to contextualize these projections. So I'm going to go through a few things that I think are key in understanding these projections.
Yes.
Firstly, we've made these projections at a provincial level. So we are capturing the dynamics at a provincial level and scaling this up to a national projection. What we are not taking into account currently is the our differences that are occurring, or heterogeneity, the variation that's in infection spread within the provinces, so within districts and within sub-districts. In order to do so, we do require a model with at a finer spatial granularity, so at a lower spatial level than province. And these models are currently in development. Okay, so that's the first thing to understand. We're making average projections at a provincial level. And secondly, when it comes to...
Can I ask a question about that before we get to the second bucket? I want to understand, does that mean you had a close look at one or two provinces and then you extrapolated to the country? Or are you saying that in each province, there were some areas, geographical that is, that you looked at closely and then made some assumptions about the one where you don't yet have data? Which is it?
Neither of the two, actually. So what we have done at a provincial level is we've looked at when the epidemic had seeded in each of the provinces, had started in each of the provinces, and we used our disease parameters to feed into our model to project where the cases are likely to end up, looking at average long-term behavior. So, I mean, I think it's important to realize again that in the long-term projections, what we are saying is that these differences that we experience at the beginning of an epidemic will tend to reduce as the epidemic progresses in the long term. And so the biological character, we do expect that the biological characteristics of the disease, its progression and its severity will be similar across the 9 provinces in the long run. So to contextualize this even further, we are sitting in the middle of May right now. So the COVID-19 has only been around globally for 4.5 months. And we are trying to make projections into the long term, 6-7 months in advance. Now, if no country in the world has yet seen the epidemic through, we have to accept, and we're quite clear about this, that there is incredible uncertainty that must be contextualized when you look at the long-term picture. We have to make the long-term projections because we have to form budgets. The decisions have to be made. Planning has to be made. But that is why it's imperative for us to understand that these projections into November will paint one picture now, but as the disease progresses and more data comes in, we will be updating this picture and communicating this more regularly as well.
Dr. Salal, around the world, the question of returning to regular economic activity has often shifted projections of infections and also projections of the death rate and the total number of deaths in a population. And I wonder whether your model has also given us different numbers in that regard, or if I can put it slightly differently, when we talk about a scenario in which 40,000 deaths might be a grim reality for us by November, what assumptions are being made there about what level of openness in terms of social behavior and economic activity goes with that projection? Are you assuming level 4, level 1, business as usual? What scenario in terms of economic activity underpins the 40,000 number?
Sure. I'm actually really glad you asked that question. So the assumption that we are making is we've now had our five-week lockdown. We're assuming a level 4 restriction from the 1st of May to the 31st of May, so on for this month. And thereafter, social distancing measures, which take into account a few things, such as school closures and the like, as a lower restriction to level 4, so a more relaxed version. I would hesitate to assign that to any particular level, so I won't comment on that, but rather to say that we're assuming that there would be a relaxed version of level 4 after the end of May, so into the month of June onwards in our projections. So to contextualize that, we need to understand that the one thing that no maths can actually capture or predict is population behavior. So on the one hand, we have restrictions and levels, but the way the population responds to these levels is perhaps the biggest game changer. And we saw this with the Ebola epidemic, and it's one of the key lessons we can take from the Ebola epidemic a few years ago, that the behavior in the population adjusting how they live their daily lives, in response to increasing mortality due to the Ebola epidemic, was perhaps one of the game changers, one of the reasons why the curve shifted in the epidemic. So what we're assuming right now is to generate this 40,000 death prediction is that there is a relaxed version of level 4 from the end of May until November. But we will update that as we get a bit more clarity and as our models can move to a more granular level beyond the provincial.
I want to talk next about our readiness in our healthcare facilities. Even on the optimistic scenario, my understanding is that fairly soon we will not have enough even ICU beds available for what the need will likely be in terms of severe cases of COVID-19 infection. What are the assumptions underpinning that? Because I would imagine part of the input data here has got nothing intrinsically to do with maths or stats, but with a important, seemingly banal question, which is to pick up the phone and to ask the Department of Health, tell us about what you've got right now in terms of PPEs and in terms of beds and stuff. So can you talk to us about the assumptions in the input data that lead to the prediction of a severe lack of ICU facilities?
Sure. So in the set of projections that we mentioned yesterday or published yesterday, the assumption is that we are trying to estimate the need for hospital services. So not necessarily use of hospital services, but the need for it. What might that total need be? And we differentiate that between severe and critical cases who will use different kinds of resources within the hospital. So the model projections currently, because we're estimating need, are not a function of capacity. A second iteration that is currently in development is taking that capacity into account to assess when and how that capacity might be exceeded, not just at a provincial or national level, but even within the district level, within districts. As of course, we know that resources do vary considerably across the country. So right now we are estimating need, which is quite different. And what we will need to take into account into the future will be the degree to which expansion is also taking place. And of course, this is best communicated from the Department of Health itself.
Dr. Salal, one thing that has confounded many public health experts and epidemiologists, they reasonably disagree, many are still testing their intuitions, is why the number of infections are particularly high and the rate of infections in terms of community spread in the Western Cape and also in the Eastern Cape. Now, I want to ask you a modeling question here, not so much an epidemiological one.
Mm-hmm.
When you have such incredible differences across provinces, and we do not yet understand the drivers behind those differences from your colleagues in other fields, like in the public health part of this this collaboration across disciplines, how does your model take account of that when there isn't homogeneity in terms of the behavior of the virus between provinces?
So what we presented yesterday were short-term and long-term projections. And in our short-term projections, we attempted to take these differences between the provinces into account. So we took into account that the disease had, or the infection had, seeded differently in the provinces and in communities with varying contact behavior. And so we attempted in our short-term projections to take into account that clusters of cases, were occurring in some provinces but not others, and that there are sharp increases that were divergent from the average pattern. So how we do attempt to take these differences into account is also through consultation with the provinces and with the epidemiologists and the public health specialists in the provinces. So this speaks very much to the collaborative process. And so we haven't mentioned this yet, but we are not operating individually. So, I mean, I'm talking to you, and I'm the director of MASHA, but MASHA is not the only institution that is involved in the model development. We all form part of the South African COVID-19 Modeling Consortium. And this consortium is a mix of academic, non-profit, and governmental institutions that's coordinated by the NICD on behalf of the National Department of Health. And the mandate of this consortium is to provide, assess, and validate the model projections that are being used and the data and the assumptions that are driving these models. And so we have experts, intensivists, clinicians, epidemiologists, public health specialists from the different provinces who present on a regular basis as to what is, what the situation is in their provinces and what the key drivers are. So it's a deeply consultative process.
Let's stick on that process question, Dr. Salal. Some people have been calling for exactly this kind of transparency about the modeling, which is why I'm delighted to be in conversation with you, because we've been needing to know what underpins government's thinking when it makes tough economic and other calls in terms of the policy decisions that it is compelled to consider, even if all of them are suboptimal. If someone is listening who's also a statistician or just a member of the public, the collaborative work that you're talking about between you and your colleagues, just on as a parenthetical question, where does it live? Is there full transparency beyond the luck of having you on my show? Could someone quietly and dispassionately right now go on a website? They can see the assumptions, do plug and play, and try and sanity test the assumptions as well as the algorithms?
So the consortium, I actually would prefer to defer this question back to the National Department of Health, as we are in discussions with them. Now, our consortium is a mixture of a number of institutions, and if there are other experts in the country who would like to be a part of that consortium, and the discussions that are happening at many academic institutions, then simply contacting contacting us will achieve that effect.
Sure.
But in terms of the communication of results, this is best handled by the National Department of Health.
Second last question: if up to 1 million people may be infected with COVID-19, is the answer similar about what level of mobility and social contact are being assumed behind it as with the death projections, i.e. a lower level than 4, whatever we may want to call them? How do we get to 1 million? Because that would assume, I would mean, all sorts of things that is close to social life as normal.
So there's something quite, I want to qualify this 1 million number. Where I think you've gotten this 1 million, I think a lot of the articles published have quoted this number of 1 million, is looking at our active symptomatic case graph. And that's a number that looks at, at the peak, what we are projecting at the peak of the epidemic, to be the infection at the time. So it isn't actually a total. But what we do need to understand is that just because the one has a symptomatic infection does not necessarily mean for COVID-19 that it is a symptomatic infection. In fact, the very vast majority of infections, more than 90% of symptomatic infections, are assumed to be mild symptoms, so not requiring hospitalization. So that's, I think, the very first important point to realize. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah. Okay, now go on with the second point, then I'll sneak in a last question if we have time.
Sure. So I think just to round up or summarize that question, that the numbers are large, but if the very vast majority of these infections are predicted or projected to be mild infections and not requiring hospitalization, it sends a different picture than just looking at a number of 1 million or even a higher number and imagining catastrophe.
Yeah, the last question is sort of a optimistic note, if I dare to try and be optimistic, despite the year we are living through, Dr. Salal, which is to say that mathematical projections are not a guarantee that the future will look like the projection. Right now, we can, can't we, upset the projections by complying? Just speak into that for me, because some people wake up to the numbers, and as one person asked me, a listener of the show, is it guaranteed that these number of people will die? I assume the answer is, well, it depends on what we do right now.
Absolutely. The answer is indeed, it depends on what we do right now. Population behavior and complying, as you say, behaving responsibly, shall we say, is our best means of combating the infection. So mathematical modeling is not a crystal ball. It's a scenario analysis, a what-if analysis tool. And that's important to realize. So perhaps the next question is, you know, what if we as a population adjust our behavior to be responsible with respect to the spread of disease?
Dr. Salal, I could listen to you the whole day. You are so lucid. You make me want to be taught by you and hang on to your every word. Thank you for making time for our show and for the work that you're doing under difficult circumstances. Thanks for coming on board.
Thank you very much for having me.